from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The night we met, I knew I needed you so. And if I had the chance. Phil Spector, musical genius, convicted murderer, creator of The Wall of Sound, eccentric recluse. His story, told again in a new HBO movie by David Mamet, follows the arc of tragedy, the brilliant rise, the great fall. He wrote and produced for the Ronettes, the Crystals, the Righteous Brothers, the Beatles, the Ramones. Then, in 2009, he was convicted of the murder of Lana Clarkson. This hour on Point, the unending story of Phil Spector. You can join the conversation. What have you made of the strange last chapter of Phil Spector? Were you dancing, swooning to his sound when the music was young? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from London is Mick Brown, author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, The Rise and Fall of Phil Spector. A reporter for The Telegraph in the UK, he interviewed Spector 5 weeks before the death of Lana Clarkson. Mick Brown, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. My pleasure.
And with us from New York is Scott Rabb, writer-at-large for Esquire. He profiled Spector for Esquire after Clarkson's death in July 2003. Scott Rabb, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Scott, you've seen the new HBO movie. Many have at this point. David Mamet wrote it, put it together. It's got Al Pacino as Phil Spector. It's got all kinds of response, many saying Mamet's kind of made an apologia for Phil Spector here. How did you see it?
I enjoyed it very much, but it was a guilty kind of pleasure. I mean, I think the disclaimer, for lack of a better term, that appeared before the film, not based on a true story, etc., was disingenuous, kind of stunning. I've never seen the like of it.
Well, the disclaimer says this is not about real people, but it's about Phil Spector.
Yeah, and again, disclaiming any notion that it was based on a true story. I don't know what the lawyerese might have been behind that. I'm not sure what Mamet's strategy was. I thought it was a bit of a comeback for Mamet himself, and I thought the performances were great. But I don't understand, you know, the entire kind of presenting this case as the relationship between a lawyer and her client.
Helen Mirren as the attorney here, Al Pacino as Phil Spector, and kind of David Mamet defending the genius. You know, he just was misunderstood. The jury didn't understand what went on. I'm reading Harriet Ryan here in the Los Angeles Times. She covered both of the trials. There was, of course, first a hung jury and then a conviction. And she ends up saying, look, the public is going to come away from this with a deeply flawed understanding of what went on. The movie suggesting that on that night when Lana Clarkson was at his mansion, the movie suggests there that she accidentally shot herself while toying suggestively with a gun. But the reporter, Harriet Ryan with the LA Times, says, look, ladies, she had her purse strap on her shoulder. Is that what you do when you're messing around with a gun? Mick Brown, I don't think it's come to the UK yet, but it's not the portrait. I mean, the portrait you have put together has been described as a portrait of pure self-interest and cruelty in Phil Spector. I guess you're not quite so ready to absolve.
Well, I hope my portrait isn't pure self-interest and cruelty. I think there are certainly more shades and dimensions mm-hmm. to Phil Spector than that. But like Harriet, I sat through most of the first trial. I didn't sit through the second trial. And you're right, I haven't seen the film, so I can't fairly comment on that. But my view at the end of the first trial, which of course ended in a hung jury, was that Phil Spector was guilty. And so I wasn't at all surprised that the second trial returned a guilty verdict.
Let's go back to the music. Put it up against what we're seeing on HBO right now, all the way back, Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Love and Feeling, 1964, performed by the Righteous Brothers, written and produced by Phil Spector. You've lost that love and feeling. Mick Brown, take us back so we can understand maybe the ragged late chapter in this life. Who was the young man who put together this incredible wall of sound idea in the late 50s, early 60s. Where did Phil Spector come from?
Well, he was an extraordinary young man. He was originally born in New York, but then moved to Los Angeles when he was about 10 or 11. And this move was actually precipitated by the suicide of his father, who killed himself. So Phil grew up in Los Angeles, physically small, diminutive, almost a runtish kind of guy, I suppose you'd say, very put upon by his classmates, an outsider, and somebody who sought consolation in music. And very early on was a very brilliant guitar player. And at the age of 17, went into a recording studio, which he'd hired with money borrowed from friends, and recorded, and wrote his first million seller, song called To Know Him Is to Love Him by the Teddy Bears. And that was in 1958. And you can really say that the period between Elvis Presley going into the army, which is about 58, and the Beatles coming along in 1964, that period in pop music almost belongs to Phil Spector. And in that period, he really rewrote the idea of what pop music could be. He was the first person to dare to dream, if you like, that pop music could be art, not just something ephemeral and throwaway, not just something for the kids in a trivial way, but that this could be great music. And true to that vision, he made great music. He made great art.
Let's listen to a little bit of that, because this is not so well known. 1958, the Teddy Bears, his group. Phil Spector was 19 when it reached number one on the Billboard charts. And of course, To Know Him Is to Love Him, inspired by the words on his father's tombstone, his father who had committed suicide. To know him is to love him. Brown, To Know Him Is to Love Him, when we know that these are the words on his suicide dead father's tombstone, I mean, never mind David Mamet, this sounds like David Lynch country, Blue Velvety, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it really is. And you can imagine this kid in his bedroom in Los Angeles writing this song, you know, basically as a tribute to his father. And the death of his father really, my understanding is that it completely devastated Phil Spector, as it would. And to compound his problems, he then grew up in this very dysfunctional family with a terribly sort of overbearing mother who would alternately nag and smother him, and a sister who was like a miniature version of his mother. And so Spector was caught in this, between this tag team of these two women who were on his case the whole time. And as you say, he wrote this song based on the words on his father's tombstone. To know him was to love him, were the words on his father's tombstone. Mm. And the irony is, of course, that when this record came out, everybody thinks it's a love song from Annette Kleinbard, who's singing that song, you know, to her boyfriend. It is a love song, but it's a love song of a very sad and unhappy young boy to his dead father.
Here from the HBO movie, Phil Spector, the character, played by Al Pacino, talking about how he invented the music business.
You lost that loving feeling.
What was it?
Are you kidding me? What was it? It was the greatest song ever released. I sold over 2.5 million copies. You say the Jews invented the music business. The Jews didn't invent the music business. I invented the music business. 7th Avenue, New York, there's a statue, little old Jewish guy, yarmulke, bent over a sewing machine. He's that guy, invented ready-to-wear. I invented the music business. Where's a statue of me? Where's the presidential medal?
Scott Rapp, you sat and talked with Phil Spector. I invented the music business. Where's the statue of me? How did he look back on that later when things were so coming apart?
Well, at that point, of course, we're dealing with the fictional portrayal of a man who we know has been convicted of murder as we're watching.
Yeah.
One of the problems I have, and I guess if Harriet Ryan, if the reporter for the LA Times finds it dispositive that Lana Clarkson had the purse strapped over her shoulder, that's one thing. It's another to simply say a jury found him guilty, therefore he's guilty. I think I'm agnostic as far as the charges go, if I can play it both ways without being accused of hypocrisy. But we are, We're talking about a guy who's, I believe the sister went insane eventually, had to be institutionalized. And I think Mick portrayed as well as anyone ever has a Phil Spector who was heavily dependent on medication to keep his psychic balance, heavily dependent on not drinking alcohol. There's no really way to know. The fact that Phil for many years was as reclusive as J.D. Salinger, essentially. Mm-hmm. And whatever ego and narcissism, all that stuff, whatever existed in him, where he honestly felt, and I believe he did, that he invented the music business, that he became the producer who could control every aspect of not just the musical production, but the money. I think he wound up being embittered.
And the people, not infrequently with a pistol in his hand. Scott Rabb with Esquire, please stand by. It's great to have you with us from New York. And Mick Brown in London, author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound. Behind us right here, Phil Spector himself singing a demo of Spanish Harlem, 1960. Co-wrote and produced the song, later a big hit for Ben E. King. Listeners, what's the bottom line in this story? Genius? Killer? Both? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Phil Spector singing on the demo. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There is a rose in Spanish Harlem. A red rose up in Spanish Harlem. With eyes as black as coal that look down in my soul and start a fire there, and then I lose control. I'll have to beg your pardon.
Today I met the boy I'm gonna marry. He's all I've wanted all my life and even more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Today I met the boy I'm going to marry, 1963, performed by Darlene Love, produced by Phil Spector behind us there. We're talking today about the unending story of music's eccentric super producer, Phil Spector, creator of The Wall of Sound, convicted murderer. Now again in the spotlight with a new film David Mamet and HBO have out, starring Al Pacino as Spector, Helen Mirren as his attorney. Mick Brown is with us from London, author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, a biography of Phil Spector. Scott Rabb is with us, writer-at-large for Esquire magazine, joins us from New York. They both have interviewed Spector, written about him at length. You can join us this hour. How do you see the bottom line in the Phil Spector story? Genius, killer, both? Did you know the wall of sound when you heard it? Know you were hearing something different? Was he right? Were these little symphonies for the kids? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And Mick, Scott, let's bring in our listeners. Frank in Hartford, Connecticut. Frank, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I consider Phil Spector to be the Irving Berlin, the Burt Bacharach of the 50s area with street kids. People are not going to remember, of course, you know, the murder, right? More than they'll remember the great music, the memories. I mean, he brought memories. He didn't just write songs like a lot of writers do. He actually, the songs that he wrote made people, made groups, and made the feelings that a lot of us who grew up in the 50s have. So basically, he is a genius. There's no two ways about it.
A simple hat tip to musical genius there. Frank, we've got it. Mick, how did he do it? What was the Wall of Sound? How did it work?
Well, I agree with Frank. I mean, I think he was a genius. But basically what Phil Spector did at that point, most rock and roll records were made by a very small combo. You'd have a guitar, a bass player, a drummer, maybe a pianist. What Spector wanted, he wanted a symphonic sound to his music. And in days before there was overdubbing, the way in which he did this was to basically double and triple up on the numbers of instruments. So instead of having one guitar player, you'd have three, four, sometimes five guitar players all playing the same chord. You'd have two bass players, you'd have two drummers, you'd have two, sometimes three people with their hands crawling over the piano. Then you'd have a brass section.
Wow.
That was how he built up the wall of sound, layer upon layer upon layer.
I mean, now it's easy compared to that, but that meant all kinds of contortions and stages, sound stages full of everything.
Exactly. And this, all of this took place in a very, very small little studio, Gold Star Studios in Los Angeles, with people crammed in. You can just imagine the atmosphere in there with cigarette butts, soda cans, coffee cartons, coffee cups strewn on the floor. Everybody getting more and more excited by the sound that was being created here. And then the final garnish, just like an Italian meal, you can never have too much garlic. The final garnish would be the echo. So when he'd got this sound and got it down on a track, it would then be fed through an echo chamber, which would give those records, not so much on the one we just played, but if you listen to a record like You've Lost That Loving Feeling or the later Crystals records, this extraordinary sort of cavernous, monumental sound that Spector literally invented. And that was a revolution in music, a revolution in sound at that time.
I don't know if I've got the cavernous sound here, but here's the Crystals, at least in name, with He's a Rebel, 1962, Phil Spector's produced.
He's a rebel and you'll never be any good. He's a rebel cause he never ever does what he should do. Just because he doesn't do what everybody else does. Oh, there's no reason why I can't give him all my love. He is always good to me, always treats me tenderly. Cause he's my rebel, no, no, no. He's my rebel, no, 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 to me.
He's a rebel. He was called a control freak. I mean, in this one, for example, the Crystals, if I've got this right, Mick, they were out of town. They weren't even actually here. It was Darling Love and the Blossoms. He just released it under the Crystals' name. He was ready to go.
That's right. Yes, I mean, he'd heard the song in New York. Another singer of the day called Vicky Carr was about to record a version, and he wanted to record a version in a hurry. So he went to Los Angeles. The Crystals, as you say, were in New York. He needed a Crystals, so to speak, and so he just hired some session singers. And he had no compunction about calling them the Crystals, because he owned the Crystals' name. And this very much embodied his sort of attitude, really, to particularly the singers that he worked with. They were really just pawns to be moved around a chessboard according to whatever strategy Phil Spector wanted to employ. And he was indeed a control freak, and he would work them very, very hard. He controlled every aspect of not only of the recording, but every aspect of the final product, of how it was released, the way it was promoted. Everything from A to Z in the entire process, Spector took control of. But if he hadn't been a control freak, he wouldn't have made the wonderful music that he did.
Hey, Scott, when did the gun come out? Are there all these stories of him waving guns around at parties, at recording sessions, you know, holding it against, what, Leonard Cohen's neck? I mean, what was that about?
I think the gunplay began many, many years ago. I think it's easy and obvious and probably true to suggest that for Philip that represented the kind of power, phallic and literal. That a short guy who had been bullied most of his life, who had no father and was overwhelmed by the women in his life whom he loved, that this in some ways provided an immediate sense of control. And we had women testifying against him in the trial. This was something that he did in order to maintain control over women who would otherwise have chosen to leave the premises.
But, I mean, we've got the women, but what about the recording artists? Why did people put up with this? It wasn't just he thought he was being, burgled at home or something and got a gun. This were not in that kind of circumstance. Why?
Well, after he was no longer able to control the artists, I mean, it was much easier for him with the girl groups. It was a different time, and it was a different, really an entirely different era of artists being under the thumb of any producer, whether it was Phil Spector or someone whose name is lost to the ages. When it came time to deal with John Lennon or Leonard Cohen or the Ramones,
yeah
it was a much different dynamic, and Phil had little alternative in terms of resort to power.
Little alternative, Mick Brown, but waving a gun?
Yeah, well, I think there's something very interesting going on here. I think in any other field, the basic fact is that I think Phil Spector was ill. And has been ill for many, many years, and it took a long time for the diagnosis to emerge, so to speak. And I think in a way the rock and roll world was the worst possible world for him to be ill in, because the way he behaved with the gunplay, the tantrums, the acting out, in a way rock and roll almost licensed him to behave like that, because it could be dismissed as eccentricity. Oh, this is just something that Phil does. Phil waves a gun around. Phil pulls out guns in the studio. What a great rock and roll story that is. In any other field, in any other world, somebody would have taken him to one side and said, look, you can't behave like this. You need to be treated for this. But as it was, he was given license almost to behave like that. And so the stories multiplied and the myth grew, and he began to behave according to the myth, you know, the more the stories multiplied. So he wasn't in the best of all possible worlds for this sort of mode of behavior to start displaying itself, really.
Darker Side showed up a little bit in the music itself, 1962. He Hit Me, It Felt Like a Kiss. About domestic violence. The Crystals here, song written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin.
He hit me, and it felt like a kiss. He hit me, but it didn't hurt me. He couldn't stand.
He hit me and it felt like a kiss. Joel in Burlington, Vermont. Joel, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think, Joel?
Well, first of all, that record, Carole King and Jerry Goffin wrote that. Carole King had an associate, one of her singers, who actually told her that story. And good songwriters write songs about anything.
Sure.
Obviously, very, very inappropriate in the social sense. But the point I wanted to make is that Phil Spector, I've been collecting his music, and it is so astonishing what he produced that he never released. It's been a game that collectors have played over the years to find these lost acetates, but Phil Spector left in the can recordings by the Crystals, the Ronettes, Darlene Love, his great artists that he never released because he found a little flaw in them. He didn't even put them on an album, and these lost masters are much better music, much better recordings than some of the, you know, A-sides released by other producers. Phil Spector is such an enigma. Just one example, he had a disagreement with Darlene Love, and Darlene had just put out a record that he had just released of hers. He pulled the record and gave the same number to the Ronettes for another, you know, the same record number on the label.
Wow.
A Ronettes record to replace it. That illustrates his control of the situation, or his need to control. The bottom line is, you have to separate the art from the human being. And I think his art has just been unequaled ever.
I understand exactly, though. Hard to entirely separate art and human, but amazing art. He could be very prickly with his artists. He could be very prickly in public. Here's a little bit of a 1965 interview. This is on the Merv Griffin Show. Phil Spector appears. He's in a ruffled shirt and cuffs and gold-headed walking stick. I mean, it's the 60s. And he proceeds to antagonize the host, Merv Griffin, and the other guests, including Eartha Kitt and the studio audience. You'll hear Merv Griffin asking Phil a question first.
What are you sensitive about?
I'm ignorant. Oh, am I sensitive about ignorance?
What? Who's ignorant?
What kind of ignorance?
Never mind now. Let's not get intellectual now. This is a pretty solid audience over here. We don't want to abuse their intelligence or anything like that. Let's get
Think it was their intelligence.
Let's get. We don't want to abuse your television by law. Uh-oh. Now, wait a minute.
Get out of it yourself, Mr. Popularity.
Mr. Popularity on Merv Griffin and Eartha Kitt. And you're the hissing there practically from the audience. Let's go to the HBO movie just out. Again, David Mamet's writing here, and this is a little scene where the defense lawyer for Phil Spector, Bruce Cutler, played by Jeffrey Tambor, tries to convince attorney Linda Kenny Bodden, played by Helen Mirren, that she should join Spector's defense team, that Spector's innocent. You'll hear Mirren, then Tambor.
Five women, count them, five women on oath before the grand jury. He pulled a gun on me, he wanted sex.
Cold sober for 10 years.
Well, and now so what, Bruce? You ever hear the phrase, to hell with it? You've got a gun nut. He goes around waving loaded guns. You've got five women come out of the woodwork. He did the same thing to me. You've got the chauffeur. The chauffeur's on record. My boss came out. I think I just killed somebody.
But in Mamet's telling for HBO, Mirren's character comes around. Frank in Hampton, Virginia. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious. There seems to be a commentary or narrative here developing. Are we going to dismiss Phil Spector's accomplishments and genius and romanticize the rock and roll era while not recognizing the distinct possibility that Phil Spector was a narcissistic sociopath that inflicted narcissistic rage on everything that he did. You know, these people are generally extremely adept at what they do. They're intelligent. And how many lives did Phil Spector affect profoundly in a negative way to market the product and basically affect a cultural phenomenon?
Frank, let me take that one right to Mick Brown. I mean, you come back to the portrait of pure self-interest and cruelty that he's been described as writing on. But how about it, Mick? I mean, the narcissistic sociopath, and yes, it may have been beautiful, but Frank wants to pay attention to the dark side here.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Certainly, I don't know about a sociopath, but certainly narcissism is one of the many accusations that you could level against Phil Spector. He was somebody, as we've said earlier, he was someone who was controlling. He was someone who was very often indifferent to other people's feelings. He was someone who always wanted to get his own way. He was somebody who, by dint of his position and his power, was indulged in those things. You could also say, and it'd be perfectly true, that he financially exploited his artists, that, you know, royalties weren't always forthcoming, thus the ensuing lawsuits from the Ronettes, from Darlene Love, from you know, a number of people who'd worked with Spector. So I mean, no, I don't think that anybody is suggesting that his extraordinary artistic accomplishments are disguising or forgiving you know, a very complicated, very difficult, and in many ways a very objectionable character. Although I have to say, and I'm sure that Scott will agree with this, having sat with Phil Spector as well, that when I met him, the side of him that I saw, he was charming, he was funny, very, very funny. He was like the guy's like a stand-up comedian. And my understanding of Spector from my own encounter with him and from the 100 or so people that I interviewed for the book is that essentially there he was a man. I don't want to simplify this, but he was a man with two very, very distinct sides, you know, and there could be a very charming side to Phil Spector, a very considerate side, a very sweet side. But he was also somebody who was in a classically mentally ill person, that he was somebody who could also act out, have tantrums, have rages, fly into uncontrollable rages, and very often alcohol was the catalyst for this. And I think that alcohol plays a very large part in Spector's life, and I think it plays a critical part in the events of the night of February the 2nd, 2003, when Lana Clarkson died.
Scott Rebb, was he self-aware about that? Did he talk with you about that?
Well, he was sober. When I saw Phil, I mean, he had done something with Esquire by email in 1999, and we spent a couple of years trying to convince him to allow me to profile him. So when I went out to Los Angeles for other stories, Phil sent a card to the hotel the first time I met him in 2001, went to the castle. There was no alcohol. Second time I visited him a year later, there was no alcohol. And when I flew back from Los Angeles to New York a couple of months after Lana Clarkson's death, He was a totally different, shrunken guy. There was no alcohol, but there were clearly a lot of pharmaceuticals involved. Whether they were prescription or not, I have no idea. But he was, as Mick describes him, a very charming, kind of an eccentric Bronx uncle. You know, he was, and he knew he was dealing with a fan, me. Mm. So he was certainly on his best behavior.
We're going to hear more from the later chapter of Phil Spector's work. We're talking this hour about the unending story of the super producer Phil Spector. Now again in the spotlight with a new film out from David Mamet and HBO. Scott Rabb of Esquire magazine is with us in New York. Mick Brown, biographer, author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, with us from London. Phil Spector got to the Beatles before too long. Well, look at that. His My Sweet Lord, 1970, produced George Harrison's album All Things Must Pass. Listeners, you can join us from You've Got That Love and Feeling to Let It Be and Lennon's Imagine. What was Phil Spector doing, creating, conveying? Would you work with a producer who liked to wave a loaded gun? Have you seen the HBO special? What do you think of David Mamet's sympathy for the man? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mick Brown, stand by in London. Scott Rabb in New York City. It's great to have you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the unending story of music super producer Phil Spector, creator of The Wall of Sound, convicted murderer, and of course now again in the spotlight with a new film from David Mamet and HBO. Stars Al Pacino as Spector, Helen Mirren as his attorney. Nick Brown is with us from London this hour, author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, bio of Phil Spector. Scott Rabb is with us, writer-at-large for Esquire magazine, joins us from New York. They both spent time, and at interesting times, with Phil Spector. Instant Karma behind us right here. He produced it for, of course, John Lennon in 1970, the first of many Beatle-related recordings Spector worked on. He also produced John Lennon's Imagine. Talk about being in the middle of things. You can join us this hour. What did you think when Phil Spector was taken off to trial in that crazy wig? What did you think at the hung jury, at the conviction? What's your last word on Phil Spector? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Mick, here's Eric writing into us on Twitter. Says Spector made staggering... I'm not sure where this one's from. Maybe on the website. It's made staggering contributions to rock and roll. Whenever I hear Bruce Springsteen's song Backstreets from Born to Run, it's pretty clear he was inspired by You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin' when he recorded that song. What about his contribution? I mean, when all the layering became so technically easy later, was everybody running, Mick, in Phil Spector's world?
Oh, that's a very good point. Firstly, I think Eric's absolutely right that Spector was an enormously influential figure, and Bruce Springsteen in particular has acknowledged that debt to Phil Spector. Meatloaf, you only have to remember songs like Bat Out of Hell, those Jim Steinman productions. You know, they're almost torn out of the Phil Spector copybook. I think one of the things that actually undermined Spector and undermined his confidence, certainly towards the end of the 60s, was the fact that in a way his sound became a sort of almost a prison for him. And there was a time around about 1965 when American radio stations stopped playing his records because they all began to sound somewhat alike. And music moved on, but Phil Spector didn't. Mm-hmm. River Deep Mountain High, for example, which was a huge hit here in Britain and which Spector regarded as the summit of the Wall of Sound.
Ike and Tina Turner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that bombed horribly in America and didn't get radio play. And so there was a sense that, you know, pop music moves on, as we know, and Spector became in a way a man out of time. So it's very interesting you should now be talking about the Beatles, because in a way that revived Phil Spector's career after 4 or 5 years in the wilderness.
Well, let's hear them both. This was 1966. He co-wrote, produced this one for Ike and Tina Turner. Spector is said to have thought of it as his best work, greatest example of his wall of sound. In the U.S., it was a flop on the charts. River Deep, Mountain High. Mick, I don't know. I mean, even to me, it starts to sound a little like muddy wallpaper there. Why did Spector think that was his best?
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I think it's a record you can kind of stand back and admire, but it's not a record you could love in the way that I love You've Lost That Loving Feeling or I love the earlier Crystals records. And I think in a way, Spector was sort of overextending himself. You know, it was getting out of control. So I can sort of understand why disc jockeys in America would have turned around and said, well, what is this thing? You know, it begins to sound a bit too much like a camel, you know, a horse designed by committee or whatever the phrase is. You know, there's too much going on there. It's too busy, too noisy. The melody doesn't seem to go anywhere. The time signatures keep changing.
Yeah.
But he was crushed. He was absolutely crushed by the failure of that. And that, in a way, fed into his idea that he was a victim of the music industry, that the music industry had turned against him. Well, they never liked me, and now they're taking their revenge. You know, one of the abiding characteristics of Spector has been his idea of himself as a martyr, and I think that's a critical moment in his own self-martyrdom.
And he more or less withdrew for several years there. When he returned, the pistol-waving producer is with all of all things with the Beatles. And suddenly here we are, 1970, Let It Be, produced by Phil Spector. Here it is. I wake up to the-
the sound of music, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be.
Out of the Beatles' Get Back recording sessions, Phil Spector produces Let It Be. Paul McCartney hated it, later released Let It Be Naked, removing, trying to take the strip Phil Spector out of it. How did he get connected, Mick Brown, with the Beatles?
Well, at that point, the Beatles had recorded the tracks for Let It Be with George Martin. And those sessions had ended in disaster, really, and George Martin wasn't sure what to do with all the tracks that had recorded. A guy called Glyn Johns had a pass at them, couldn't make that work either. The Beatles were being managed by Alan Klein, who was an old sidekick of Phil Spector's from New York in the 60s. And so it was Klein who suggested that they might bring in John Lennon. They might bring in Phil Spector. And Lennon and George Harrison were both embraced this idea with great relish. And so Spector was flown over to London to fix the Let It Be album, as it were. And almost the first thing that he did on arriving in London, John Lennon was just going into the studio to record Instant Karma. So he invited Phil Spector to go in and produce that. And so that began that association. First of all, he produced Instant Karma for John Lennon. Then he fixed the Let It Be album, or ruined the Let It Be album, if you're Paul McCartney. But then went on to record several more albums with John Lennon. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the George Harrison as well, the All Things Must Pass record.
Let's go to Paula in Newington, Connecticut. Paula, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm very upset about this show. What I hear is a bunch of men excusing a man who was a serial abuser because he had a genius in one area of his life. But what he was and is a serial abuser of women. Ronnie Spector had to flee her home with him in bare feet with just the clothes on her back, not a dime in her pocket,
yep,
with the help of her mother in order to get away from him. He would not even let her walk outside the house with shoes on because he did not want her to be out of his control.
No question.
I mean, he is just the most obnoxious person I've ever heard of. And you're talking about him as if none of this other part of his life mattered.
Oh, I don't think we're going to go there, though it is clear in the Mamet HBO film, there's a lot of sympathy for him. But Mick and Scott, I'll bring it to each of you. Paul, I really appreciate your call. I mean, you talked about prison earlier, Mick. You know, the stories of him keeping multiple women essentially prisoner in his mansion, and not least Ronnie of the Ronettes, what multitudinous.
Yes, and I'd agree with Paula's point. Disagree with the fact that we're excusing his behavior. I don't think anybody would excuse Phil Spector's behavior. And I think, as we've said earlier, you know, there's a very clear distinction to be made between the musical genius and the deeply flawed man. Nobody would excuse the way that Phil Spector has behaved, and Paula is absolutely right. I mean, Ronnie Spector's life was hell for the time that she was married to him, and as we saw in the trial, there were five women, no fewer than five women, who came forward to testify that they'd been kept virtual captive by Spector in his home, that he'd pulled guns on them. I think, you know, Spector did have a particularly difficult time with women, or rather, I should say that women had a particularly difficult time with Phil Spector. He didn't know how to behave with women. He didn't know how to treat women. He didn't know how to have a respectful relationship with women. And the Lana Clarkson murder is the bitter culmination of that.
Scott Rabb, how did he talk about women with you? And what about the serial abuser characterization? It's not hard to come to that, as Paula does here.
Well, he was dismissive in general, I think, of the artists that he worked with, including George Harrison had complained about All Things Must Pass in much the same way McCartney did about Let It Be, and he was dismissive of that. And when I saw him, you know, with women at the castle, there were a couple of women. There was a pizza party, and they wanted to explore the various rooms of the house, and it would, you know, Phil just cut that off right away. There was nothing polite about his behavior toward women. I would like to point out, and I think this is a salient point, he was convicted, and he is 73 years old. He will be in prison, not even eligible for parole, until he's 88 years old. And the sins that he committed are the sins that he committed. And you know, I don't know what more anyone could ask in terms of punishment of Phil Spector.
I mean, of course, Lana Clarkson's dead, so that's a pretty dire ending to her story there.
Yeah, can I just say here that I think in all of this, and again, I should emphasize that I haven't seen the film, so I can't speak to the film, but that in all of the discussion about Phil Spector and about his life and about his career and about what actually happened, that Lana Clarkson is very much the forgotten person in all of this, and it was clearly the defense strategy to the classic defense strategy is, you know, put the victim on trial, and Lana Clarkson's name and reputation was dragged through the mud. They did everything they could to depict her as a sad, sorrowful, washed up, suicidal has been. I spoke to a lot of friends of Lana Clarkson researching my book, and that and evidence that came out in the trial. Lana Clarkson was not the person that the defense tried to depict her as being. You know, she was a vibrant, intelligent, lovable, and much loved woman. And I think it's true that she has been the person who's forgotten in all of this. And I think that needs to be said.
Let's go to Tom calling from Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, fellas. How you doing?
Okay.
That's good. Glad to hear it. Reason for my call is I'm a big Ramones fan, and I know Phil Spector worked on one Ramones record, End of the Century. The Ramones being a band that I find this chapter extremely interesting for two reasons. The one being that the Ramones are a band that practiced such a minimalist style where they were trying to do get the most out of very limited musicianship and very, you know, playing a three-chord style.
Mm-hmm.
And then working with Phil Spector, which appears to be the antithesis of everything Ramones. And then in addition to that, the other thing I found interesting was that it seems like they were a group that was actually able to challenge him in terms of being volatile. They themselves, one member or at least one member wound up walking out during the recording sessions and he finished it with other musicians. I was wondering if you could just touch on, first of all, your thoughts about that collaboration, mm-hmm. and also about the different how having a volatile group affected him and what that sort of situation.
We'll do it, Tom. We'll do it. The Ramones and Phil Spector. We've got a little bit of that collaboration here. This is 1980, End of the Century. Do You Remember Rock and Roll Radio? Mick Brown, how did they do it? How did these work together? Did they take Phil Spector's sometimes kind of crazy guff?
I think there was a lot of, Tom's right, there was a lot of tension, a lot of friction on those sessions. But basically, I think the only person, the only member of the Ramones that Phil Spector was interested in was Joey, was the lead singer. And, you know, he saw Joey as Ronnie Spector in a way. You know, he saw him as someone that had a great voice who he could use. And I think as far as Spector was concerned, the other members of the group were essentially dispensable. And as Tom says quite rightly, that in the end, one of them walked and the others were the other two were so marginalized. It's interesting, that record. Hearing it now, it reminds me in a way of a sort of 1958 New York record, somebody like Freddie Cannon or someone like that. So I think it was very much Phil Spector, in a way, going back to his sort of New York roots and New York pop roots. It certainly doesn't sound like the Ramones three-chord, bamma, bamma, bamma.
It's very Spector. He did something to get them on his
Spector-ish.
Group. Yeah. I want to hear, this is just one more little piece from the movie. Again, Helen Mirren playing his defense lawyer, Laura Kenny Bodden here. David Mamet script suggesting that the L.A. District Attorney's Office needed to convict Spector since they did not. They failed to convict other celebrities in high-profile criminal cases.
They let O.J. go. They let Michael Jackson go. They are not going to let him go. They will be trying him for the murder of O.J.'s wife, and they will find him guilty.
Boy, the Atlantic calls the Mamet script here a dodge and a half-hearted apologia. What do you think made David Mamet so apparently sympathetic to this man in this case, Scott?
Well, I think there's some projection there. I think, you know, Mamet is a Jewish guy of a certain age, may have bonded with Phil's music as a lot of guys did, as I did. you know, early in life. And there also is the context. It is not to speak directly to Philip's guilt or innocence in the case of Lana Clarkson, to say it did take place in a context where the judge and everyone else covering the trial was quite aware of a series of horrifying crimes, celebrities for which celebrities had been tried and set free. Can't be denied. That does not mean Phil Spector was not guilty, but that was in many ways the cultural context in Los Angeles for the trials of Phil Spector.
Mick Brown, how do you draw a line under this life? I mean, he's still there in prison in California, but as we hear, 88 before he's out. How do you add up such a life?
Well, I mean, he is of course appealing. There's another appeal going through, although I can't say that I can't imagine that's going to be successful, any more successful than the previous two. How do you draw a line under that life? I mean, I think the line to be drawn is this great tragedy, really, and it's the dichotomy that we've been talking about through the program, is that, you know, he was a great artist, a great record producer, a musical genius, but a deeply flawed human being. And for me, one of the great tragedies of all of this is that the thing that Phil Spector will be remembered for is for the murder of Lana Clarkson, not for "You've Lost That Loving Feeling."
Hard to put those two together, murder and loving feeling. Yeah. They sit in this man's biography. Mick Brown tells it well in Tearing Down the Wall of Sound. Mick, in London with us today, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
And Scott Rabb, writer-at-large for Esquire magazine, in New York with us today. Scott, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with just one more, The Righteous Brothers' Unchained Melody, produced by Phil Spector. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.